ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
As we observe Remembrance Day and lives lost in wars, both past and present, today on Big Ideas, this incredible war story of art, of espionage, and actually Professor Arthur Dale Trendall was more famous as an art historian. Turns out that talent was handy for something else, something secretive, hidden from view, inside a Melbourne apartment block called Monterey. This was Australia's answer to Britain's Bletchley Park, deciphering the messages of our enemies.
Now, there was a book published recently about Monterey and also the Brisbane groups of cryptographers in Australia during the Second World War. And this book doesn't mention Trendall much, but it does briefly note that Trendall's skills as a linguist were important for his war work, but also that he was a world expert on South Italian pottery. And the book says, not much use in solving codes. I would argue to the contrary. It was precisely Trendall's ability and experience in detecting significant patterns in the large amount of graphic information provided by thousands of South Italian vases, which, along with his linguistic skills, made him a brilliant cryptographer.
But just how did an unassuming, Kiwi-born, Cambridge-educated art historian with a special knowledge of ancient Greek vase painting come to lead a crack team of codebreakers deciphering Japanese messages in Melbourne, directly contributing to the Allies' success in the Pacific? Hey, welcome to Big Ideas. My name is Natasha Mitchell, and bringing us this incredible story from World War II is Dr. Gillian Shepherd, who is director of the Trendall Research Centre for Ancient Mediterranean Studies and a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. She's speaking at the Melbourne's Shrine of Remembrance today with an audience on Boonwurrung country.
Professor A.D. Trendall is known today in the academic world as an ancient art historian and a renowned expert on what is known as South Italian vase painting. These were the painted vases that were produced in southern Italy and Sicily in antiquity, in areas that had been settled since the 8th century CE by the ancient Greeks. But in the late 5th and 4th centuries, these places started to produce pottery decorated in red and black, at first influenced by rather similar products from Athens, but increasingly developing their own styles and subject matter. That was what Trendall was an expert on, but what I'd like to talk about tonight is a much less well-known aspect of Trendall's life and work, and that is his encounters with the world of espionage, and in particular his work as a codebreaker during the Second World War. This is not an entirely easy task, because it must be said that Trendall was very reluctant to talk about this period of his life. In fact, he once commented that he had deliberately tried to erase it from his memory. And also, before he died, he pretty much disposed of everything in the way of documents and so forth that related to his life and work during this period, other than his work in South Italian vase painting. But he did give an interview on his war work in 1990, and there are some other sources as well. And I should say, though, in preparing this talk, I'm very much indebted to the memories and anecdotes of Trendall's close friend and colleague Ian McPhee, and also to those who have previously researched Trendall's wartime code-breaking activities, especially Desmond Ball, David Sissons, and Robert Merrilies. Let me start, though, by introducing Professor Trendall. He was a New Zealander. Arthur Dale Trendall, also always known as Dale, was born in Auckland on the 28th of March 1909. He was an only child, and he attended King's College School in Auckland, where he proved to be very good at maths and also languages, including Latin. He then went on to study at the University of New Zealand at Otago, where he really developed his interest in classics and especially Greek art, to which he was introduced by his great mentor there, Professor Adams. In 1931, Trendall travelled to England to continue his classical studies at Trinity College, Cambridge, and there he was supervised by the classicist A.S.F. Gow. Now, that was not a relationship that got off to a very good start. As Trendall left their first meeting, he heard Gow exclaim, "Another damned colonial!" But after that, the relationship between teacher and student got much better. And in fact, it was through Gow that Trendall was introduced to the Oxford scholar John Beazley, an expert on ancient Athenian vase painting. And it was Beazley's work that very much inspired Trendall's study of South Italian pottery. Now, Beazley's work involved the attribution of ancient Athenian vases to particular vase painters. Now, these vases, of which there are tens of thousands, are only very rarely signed by their makers. Occasionally, they bear the name of the potter or the painter or both. Sometimes the potter and the painter are one and the same person. But despite this lack of signatures, Beazley was able to attribute individual vases to particular hands. Now, he never explained his methods, but he seems to have been using what is known as the Morellian method. Now, this was an approach that had been developed by the 19th century art historian Giovanni Morelli, who studied early Renaissance art, which likewise contains a great number of unsigned works. And what Morelli developed as his method was not to look at the overall style of an artwork, because it's easy enough to imitate a general style, but to look at the tiny little details, the way an artist depicts the toenails or the nostrils or the drapery folds, all those little idiosyncrasies that effectively form the signature of an individual artist. And Beazley was able to adapt this method and apply it very successfully to Athenian vase painting. So, if we take, for example, the work of a painter known as the Berlin painter. Now, these individual painters have modern made-up names. We will never know their real names. And Beazley and Trendall made up names on various grounds, such as the favourite motifs of a particular artist. So, for example, Beazley called one painter the painter of the spotted snakes. Or, in the case of the Berlin painter, after the City Museum, where one of his most famous works was kept. Now, the Berlin painter's work is betrayed by a number of specific little details. He tends to like figures that appear as if they are spotlit on a stage. And he also had a tendency to draw the lower part of the upper arm in such a way that it joined and became the body and became part of the chest muscles. The way he did the ankle bone was also very distinctive. He would do two little squiggly lines that together almost look like a tiny pair of pliers. These are the sorts of little idiosyncrasies that give away a particular hand. And it was through this sort of method of connoisseurship that Beazley was able to put a huge amount of artistic and archaeological evidence into order. And that meant that once it was ordered, particularly through painter and also chronologically, we were all in a much better position to understand the imagery on the vases and from that ancient Greek culture and society. Now, Trendall was very interested in this, and he was further inspired to follow this sort of a study by his first visit to Italy in 1932. Trendall visited Pistum in southern Italy, which then and now is an absolutely spectacular site with three very well-preserved temples dating to between the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. And this site very much inspired Trendall to study the red-figured pottery which was produced here and also in other centres in southern Italy and Sicily. Now, at the time, in the 1930s, South Italian pottery was really desperately unfashionable as an area of study. It was regarded as rather inferior, a bit sort of provincial, colonial, second rate in comparison to the products of Athens. And not much work had been done in the field, so Trendle was really able to corner it. And he started with the vases produced in Paestum, and he published his first significant work, Paestum Pottery, in 1936. And again, he was studying these vases and attributing them in much the same way Beazley had with Athenian vase painting. Now, of course, 11 years after Trendle visited Paestum, the site would have looked very different. Paestum was the location of the landing beaches of the US 36th Infantry Division on September the 9th in 1943, during the Allied invasion of Italy, which stretched southward from Salerno. The ancient site was very much occupied by the Allies. The US Army set up a transceiver office in amongst the columns of the Temple of Hera II, more romantically known as the Temple of Neptune. And there were also Allied Red Cross first aid tents in and around the temples. The temples were fortunately regarded as off limits for bombing by both sides in the war. Trendle, though, continued his work on ancient pottery as best he could. And from his study of Paestum pottery, Trendle went on to identify the products and artists of four other main areas of production: Campania, Lucania, Apulia, and Sicily. And this was his life's work. So, for example, in amongst the collection at the Trendle Centre, we have a piece of Lucanian pottery. It's just a fragment, but it fairly clearly shows the centre of a well-known myth, the Centauromachy, the battle between the Lapiths, the legendary group who lived in central Greece, and the Centaurs, the half-man, half-horse creatures. Now, this fragment shows the forelegs of a horse, but they're clearly attached to a human torso, and there's also just the end of an elbow in the image, so this is obviously a centaur. And a human Lapith is there too. He's got a helmet and shield, and he's about to plunge his spear into the centaur. Now, Trendle attributed this fragment to a painter he called the Palermo painter. And he did this on the basis of a number of features, especially the rounded chin of the Lapith, the rather fleshy lower lip, the shorter upper lip, the upper eyelid lines that don't quite join together, and just the black dot for a pupil. These are all very distinctive traits of the Palermo painter's work. But I'm getting a bit ahead here. Let's go back to the early stages of Trendle's career. He graduated from Cambridge in 1933, and he sent a telegram to his parents in New Zealand to announce this to him. The telegram reads, "First class in classical tripos with distinction top in archaeology, given grant for research, tell Archdale and Professor Adams." So what he'd actually achieved is what's called a starred first at Cambridge. In other words, he got first class honours all the way through. And the other student in his year at Trinity, who also achieved a starred first in classics, was one Enoch Powell. More on Powell shortly, but just for now, remember that Dale Trendle was studying at Trinity College, Cambridge in the early 1930s. Hold on to that thought, I'm going to come back to it. Trendle then spent several years in Rome as the librarian of the British School at Rome. And he left Italy then for a fellowship at Trinity College. But he didn't stay long in Cambridge. In 1939, while he was actually in New Zealand visiting his parents, he was invited to apply for the position of Professor of Greek at Sydney University. This post had just been vacated by that very same Enoch Powell. Now, Powell is today best known as a post-war British politician, especially through his notorious Rivers of Blood speech in Birmingham in 1968, in which he criticised mass immigration, especially from the Commonwealth, into the UK. But Powell was also a formidable classicist. And that infamous speech of his, in fact, bore the hallmark of his classical education. Powell declaimed, "As I look ahead, I am filled with foreboding. Like the Roman, I seem to see the River Tiber foaming with much blood. And this is, of course, a direct allusion to a passage in the Roman poet Virgil's epic poem, The Aeneid, where the Sibyl foresees the bloodshed that must ensue in order for Rome to be founded. But in 1939, Powell asserted that he was leaving Australia for Britain because war was looming in Europe and he was quite disgusted at Neville Chamberlain's dealings with Germany. He was helped in this by the offer of a position at Durham University, but it also seems he was really rather keen to escape what he quite undoubtedly saw as the cultural backwater of the Antipodes. Trendle used to tell the story of Powell attending a very smart Sydney cocktail party, and when the hostess thanked him for coming, Powell replied, "Yes, but it won't happen again." So Dale Trendle arrived in Sydney just as the Second World War broke out, and his academic work was necessarily curtailed. He could no longer make trips to European museums and sites, which were so essential for his work. He did, though, still manage to be productive in his position. For example, in 1942, he published a detailed study of the Shellal mosaic. Now, this is a 6th century CE mosaic, which had been uncovered in the First World War in 1917 in Palestine by the Anzac Mounted Division. It is now, somewhat controversially, in the Australian War Memorial, but Trendle was the first to examine it in detail. And for the colour plates of his 1942 publication, he commissioned the artist Napier Waller to do paintings of the mosaic. Napier Waller was, of course, most famous for his stained glass and mosaics in the War Memorial itself, but also quite a number of works in Melbourne, including in the Town Hall, and the ones I remember from my childhood, the murals of the Mural Hall in the Meyer Emporium. Trendle, though, still kept in touch with ASF Gow, his old tutor at Cambridge. Throughout the war, Gow sent sort of round-robin letters to his former pupils, who were now scattered all over the world doing war work of various sorts, and he would update them on what was going on in Cambridge during wartime. He did expect, where possible, that his former pupils should send him letters back, though he recognised that that might not always be possible, given the war. But between 1939 and 1944, Gow sent some 70 of these letters, which he referred to as his parish magazine. And they were later published in a volume called Letters from Cambridge, 1939 to 1944. Now, we're not sure exactly when Dale Trendle got on his recipient list, but he did receive them. And in the Trendle Centre, we have two of the original letters sent by Gow, numbers 51 and 52. And number 52, which is dated the 28th of November 1943, is especially entertaining, I think. In it, Gow alerts his recipients to the fact that he has a new pair of corduroy trousers. These are much warmer than their predecessors, apparently, because, as Gow says, this is not surprising because I took to them not so much to be in the fashion as because the pair they replace exhibited to the public gaze larger areas of skin than seemed becoming. He also noted that the Cambridge University Library was filled with women. He had no objection to their education, but feared that they spent too much time powdering their noses and writing to their boyfriends. I'm not sure that the male students were doing anything much more profitable, but there you are. He also noted of these women that he feared that they foster a spirit of malevolence among senior members of the university, whom I sometimes catch eyeing their serried ranks with positive venom. Even in the 1940s wartime, women were still not entirely welcome in Cambridge.
What a set of characters in this wartime tale, hey? With archaeologist, historian and classicist Dr. Gillian Shepherd remembering the life of art historian A.D. Trendle and uncovering really a little-known story of his foray into the secret world of intelligence during the Second World War. on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, and you can find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Natasha Mitchell. It's great to have your company today. So just how do these codes work and how do you decipher them? Back to Gillian to explain.
Back in Sydney, Trendle was trying to continue his university work as best he could, and he was helped by his friends and contacts overseas, especially in the purchase of new artefacts for the Nicholson Museum at Sydney University, of which he was honorary curator. Now, purchasing antiquities is never easy. It was easier in the 1930s, but not when there was a war going on. But he was helped in particular by a friend of his in London called Noel Oakeshott. And she would look out for vases coming up for sale in London that she thought he might be interested in, and she acted for Trendle if he wished to purchase them for the Nicholson Museum. So in 1942, having acquired on Trendle's behalf a Lucanian bell crater that at the time was attributed to the Dolon painter, it's now been reattributed to the Maniti group, she purchased that for him. And she'd also spotted a Peaston vase attributed to Python that he thought he would be interested in. So she cabled Australia. And the telegram read, "Dolon dispatched, have Python £10. Trendle often recalled the summons from the Australian military censor to explain the apparently quite obviously encoded contents of her message. It was, of course, a perfectly innocent message, but if the military censors had had anything of a classical education, they would have immediately recognised the name Dolon and have been extra suspicious. In the ancient Greek myths of the Trojan War, Dolon is the Trojan soldier who volunteered to spy on the Greek camp. Now, it has to be said that Dolon was not a very good spy. He put on a wolf skin and a weasel cap, which he somehow thought he was going to camouflage himself with. But in fact, as he made his way to the Greek camp, he was spotted almost immediately by the Greek heroes Odysseus and Diomedes, who killed him as soon as he had spilled the beans on exactly what the Trojans were up to. The Dolon painter takes his name from a South Italian vase in the British Museum, which depicts this very story. And the scene shows Dolon in a forest. Dolon's in the middle. He's wearing his skins, and on either side are Odysseus and Diomedes about to apprehend him. However, the impact of the Second World War on Trendle's work went far beyond antiquities shopping and called upon his particular intellectual skills. In late 1939, the Chief of Naval Staff proposed that an Australian code-breaking organisation be established. And as a result, in January 1940, a small group was formed in Sydney and asked to start studying Japanese signals traffic. This group was composed of two Sydney University mathematicians, Professor T.G. Room and Mr. R.J. Lyons. And there was also Mr. A.P. Trawick, a lecturer in Greek. And of these three, Anastasius Trawick was the only one of them who knew some Japanese and who also had a military rank. He was a major. This group soon invited the newly arrived Dale Trendle to join them. So there was a group of four of them, and they were highly skilled in mathematics and languages, both extremely useful in code breaking. Trendle, of course, was good at both, and especially adept in the complexities of highly inflected languages like ancient Greek and Latin, which require a great deal of logic and a very good understanding of the mechanics of a language. And indeed, Trawick later commented that Trendle, as a highly gifted linguist, simply absorbed Japanese, despite never taking any lessons in it. Anyhow, together this group studied cryptography, mainly at the weekends in their spare time, and they were provided with some Japanese messages to practice on. And by early 1941, they succeeded in breaking LA code, a relatively simple Japanese cipher used for low-level messages. But they were given other sorts of messages to practice on too. One was a letter in dot code that had been intercepted by the postal censorship. And it turned out to be a very steamy love letter written by an eminent British gentleman, he had a knighthood, who was working in China and conducting an affair with a married woman living in Melbourne. And apparently its contents were really very explicit, quite a torrid, in fact. So much so that the Sydney academics proposed that the letter be sent on to its recipients, but with inserted at the beginning in the same dot code, careful, exclamation mark. We don't know whether the censors followed this advice or not. At this point, it might just be worth going over some absolute basics of cryptography or creating codes, not least because I had to get my head around this stuff myself. We tend to use the word code rather generically and often interchangeably with cipher, but technically they are two different features of cryptography. Code refers to whole words, which can be represented by a different word. So, for example, if we take that innocent message which raised the suspicions of the Australian military censor, Dolan dispatched, have Python 10 pounds. In a completely imaginary, simple code of word substitution that could have really meant something like, say, Smith killed, blogs captured last week. Now, obviously, the more words that are encoded, the more complicated this gets and more the more cumbersome. And to understand it, one needs a code book, in other words, a list of the code words and their meanings. It's possible, of course, though, to only encode very sensitive keywords, which can be very effective because it means that a coded message can appear quite deceptively innocuous. A cipher, though, is different. A cipher refers to the letters of a word, and for a cipher, letters, numbers, or numerals can be used. So, for example, a very simple cipher would be to use the alphabet where each letter is moved on by one. So A becomes B, B becomes C, C becomes D, and so on. So that would mean that our message about Dolan and Python would end up as a sort of gobbledygook string of letters where Dolan is spelt not D-O-L-O-N, but E-P-M-P-O. Now, the recipient must obviously understand the basic algorithm of the cipher, but there's also the key to the cipher, which can change frequently, even on a daily basis, and that provides a further specific rule by which the cipher has been written. So the recipient must also have this key, or if you're the codebreaker, you need to be able to work it out. Now, the frequency of letters or numerals or symbols is critical here. Particular letters are used with more or less frequency in certain languages, especially vowels, and so examining that frequency can be a starting point for breaking the code. Now, this sort of example is a simple substitution cipher, where one letter stands in for another, but you can also have a transposition cipher in which the order of the letters is changed. And of course, the cipher can also use encoded words as an extra layer of encryption. So, for example, in this cipher, Dolon, spelled E-P-M-P-O, means Dolon, but Dolon could still be the code word for Smith. Now, of course, this is school kid level stuff. It all gets a lot more complicated than this in reality. But it was these sorts of essentials of cryptography that the Sydney group were training themselves in. Now, such was the success of this group that it prompted the creation of something more formal. Commander Eric Nave was an Australian naval officer who specialised in Japanese, and since early 1940, he'd run a small intelligence unit in Victoria Barracks in Melbourne. And it seems to have been through Eric Nave's initiative that a new section devoted to the breaking of Japanese diplomatic codes was set up. And this resulted in Professor Room, Mr. Lyons and Major Trewick, with the agreement of Sydney University, being called up for full-time duty in Melbourne, and they moved to Melbourne in the middle of 1941. Trendle, though, remained in his post in Sydney, but he was to be available for some part-time study if required. The situation, though, of course, was to change very rapidly. In that same year, 1941, on December the 7th, came the attack on Pearl Harbor. Japan and the USA entered the war formally, and Australia found itself in a very different strategic position. And so, on the 12th of January 1942, Trendle reported for duty in Melbourne to Commander Nave. Now, initially, the Codebreakers worked in Victoria Barracks, but in March 1942, they moved to a block of flats called Monterey. This block of flats still exists. It's on the corner of Arthur Street and Queen Street near Albert Park. At the time, Monterey was brand new, so new, in fact, that it didn't have any heating. But it was here that the offices for Nave's Special Intelligence Section were set up. And these flats were also the home of FRUMAL, the Fleet Radio Unit Melbourne, which was one of two major Allied signals intelligence units in the Pacific area. The other one was in Hawaii. Now, Room, Lyons and Trewick continued to work directly under Nave and later in 1942 were deployed in different directions. But Trendle was put in charge of the group breaking the Japanese diplomatic codes. And over time, he was joined by a number of new recruits, and in total, 33 staff, codebreakers, language experts and administrative staff, worked at one time or another in this group breaking Japanese diplomatic codes between January 1942 and the end of the war. And these men and women did extraordinary work. But I will just mention two of them with particular connections to Trendle and his work. One was Ronald Sidney Bond. He, at just 19 years old, had finished his degree at Sydney University with first-class honours in both Latin and Ancient Greek. And, of course, he'd been taught by both Trewick and Trendle. He, in fact, became Trendle's deputy at the Special Intelligence Section and, in fact, also replaced him when Trendle finally returned to Sydney University full-time in 1944. The other important person was a British consular officer called Arthur Cooper. Arthur Cooper arrived shortly after the move to Monterey, and he was an expert in Chinese and Icelandic. He'd been evacuated from Singapore, and he'd taken his pet gibbon with him. This gibbon was called Tertius, which is arguably not a very imaginative name, since it seems that Tertius was indeed the third gibbon that Cooper had owned. And Cooper managed to smuggle Tertius into Australia. So Tertius was, as Trendle commented, a highly illegal gibbon. But Cooper and Tertius were devoted to each other, always together, with Tertius hanging on to Cooper and his long tail hanging down below Cooper's jacket. Cooper spent less than a year at Monterey. He was recalled to Britain in December 1942, and he didn't return to Australia during the war. But he did make a very positive impression on Trendle. In that 1990 interview, Trendle recalled Cooper as having a very fine brain. He said, for intelligence purposes, he was very much at the top of the tree. I must say that I think that in that last tree comment, there's probably a monkey joke, knowing Trendle's very wicked sense of humour.
And keep listening to find out what happened to Tertius the gibbon. These certainly were different times. On ABC Radio National, you're tuned to Big Ideas, and we are joined by Dr. Gillian Shepherd today at Melbourne's Shrine of Remembrance with a wartime tale of art, espionage and intrigue. I'm Natasha Mitchell, and to mark Remembrance Day, we are remembering the life of A.D. Trendle, art historian turned codebreaker during the Second World War.
Now, the Japanese had a whole range of codes, but three of them are especially significant here. I've already mentioned LA code. That was the one the codebreakers cracked in Sydney in 1941. And it was a very simple code. It was indicated by the letters LA at the beginning of each message. And it was composed of bigrams and tetragrams. Bigrams being two letters in the form of consonant vowel or vowel consonant, and tetragrams were combinations of two bigrams. Because of its simplicity, it was a relatively low-grade code, and the messages rarely contained anything of real value. It seems to have been used by the Japanese officials mainly to keep the information secret from post office officials. Occasionally, though, mistakes were made, and very confidential information was sent in LA code by mistake. But in 1942, four Japanese codes and two ciphers were in use. and all four codes could be read, and almost all of the traffic in what's called the Fuji cipher. Now, the Fuji cipher was in use between June 20th, 1941 and June 30th, 1943, and it was composed of unrestricted bigrams and tetragrams. The bigrams were used for numerals, punctuation, and very common short words, whereas the tetragrams were for longer words, phrases, place names, and also some numerals. In total, there were 676 bigrams and 900 tetragrams. So that gives you a vocabulary of 1,576 groups. And it was the main task of Trendle's special intelligence section to break the daily key for this Fuji cipher. According to Ronald Bond in a later interview, Trendle devised an ingenious method of working out this daily key and from there breaking the Fuji cipher. Now, what they were reading were diplomatic messages, and their value were especially to do with economic warfare. It is the case that up until the end of 1942, shipping information was sent in diplomatic codes. And the British were very interested in Japan's supply needs, including, for example, their wooden ship construction and their need for Swedish ball bearings and Turkish chrome. But one message which the codebreakers read must have been a source of particular satisfaction. It was from the Japanese ambassador in Budapest to the Japanese foreign ministry, and it was to assure the Japanese that the Germans were worried about the Allies reading his messages. But the ambassador assured Tokyo that this was extremely unlikely because Japanese was such a difficult language. And this message was read loud and clear by Trendle and his team of codebreakers in Melbourne. Some, though, were a cause of much more concern. One message obtained via Kabul showed that a Japanese agent had been present at a British naval trial and was supplying details of the carriers and battleships stationed in Bombay. And another was the discovery in 1942 that the Japanese were able to read field communications between Australian guerrilla troops in Timor. Now, this was perhaps not a huge surprise, as Australian ciphers at the time were not very high level. And in fact, Anastasius Trewick claimed he'd been able to break the Australian cipher in under an hour. But it was a problem that had to be remedied, and Trendle stepped up to the plate and did just that. He invented a new cipher called Trencode. Now, Trencode seems to have been highly effective. It was simple enough to be used easily in the field, but sufficiently complicated that it took hours or even days to break it, by which time the information it contained had been and gone. It was redundant. Anastasius Trewick also set himself the challenge of breaking Trencode. He succeeded, but it did apparently take him a long time, and Trendle said he cheated a bit. Now, Trencode seems to have been in use by the Australian military from until at least 1946, which strikes me as quite a long time for a military code. I have tried, so far without success, to get a sample of Trencode. I feel there must be a copy in some filing cabinet somewhere. I believe, though, it might be the case that the Trencode files are still classified by the Department of Defence, so I might have to do some further investigation there. Now, by the end of 1942, Arthur Cooper had been recalled to England and the Monterey Diplomatic Code Team was moved back to Victoria Barracks and renamed D Special Section. Their work was pretty tough, though. The intercept traffic was increasing and Trendle and Bond were working 7 days a week, sometimes late into the night, just to keep up with it. So some more assistance was needed and Trendle trained up a number of new recruits to the point where he could return to Sydney for a while to deal with university matters. He went on the 13th of March in 1943, but he was recalled to Melbourne in July. The Japanese were introducing new ciphers and Trendle's expertise was needed. Now, one of these ciphers had the acronym of the Greater East Asian Ministry, GEAM or GEAM, and it was a transposition cipher with a bigram and tetragram code. The bigrams were in the form consonant vowel or vowel consonant, and the tetragrams were composed of a double consonant plus a bigram. GEAM was introduced on the 21st of July in 1943, and by the 12th of August, Dale Trendall had broken it. He beat his rivals in both London and Washington. Earlier this century, David Sissons tried to replicate the method by which Trendall broke Guillaume, and he admitted he got a certain way, but he couldn't arrive at the complete solution and in the end had to admit defeat. Interestingly, though, it's also true that Trendall himself couldn't explain it. In that 1990 interview, he simply said he had an inexplicable ability to see patterns in encoded text. Now, it seems to me that an inexplicable ability must be, in large part, a natural ability, combined perhaps with his training in other disciplines. Trendall was finally released by the army on the 16th of November in 1944, and he returned to Sydney University and his life as an academic, though it is thought possible that Trendall, in fact, went on advising about recruitment to the Special Intelligence Section until well after the war. But his contribution to that war effort was certainly very significant. His natural abilities, including the mathematical mind, an aptitude for and training in languages, certainly would have made him a prime candidate for a role as a codebreaker. But I'd argue that it was also his skills in connoisseurship in ancient Greek vase painting, in this attribution of South Italian vases to particular painters, which was a critical factor also. Now, there was a book published recently about Monterey and also the Brisbane groups of cryptographers in Australia during the Second World War. And this book doesn't mention Trendall much, but it does briefly note that Trendall's skills as a linguist were important for his war work, but also that he was a world expert on South Italian pottery. And the book says, not much use in solving codes. I would argue to the contrary. It was precisely Trendall's ability and experience in detecting significant patterns in the large amount of graphic information provided by thousands of South Italian vases, which, along with his linguistic skills, made him a brilliant cryptographer. Now, Trendall's adventures in the world of espionage didn't quite end with the Second World War. A few years ago, I was rummaging around in the online catalogue of the National Archives in Canberra, and I was intrigued to find the archives hold three ASIO surveillance reports on Trendall dating to the 1960s. So I got hold of the copies, and they seemed to me to be two telephone tapping reports and one interview report. Now, as it happened at the time, a friend of my parents had been, before his retirement, deputy director of ASIO. So I was able to take these documents to a top spy and ask his opinion of them. And he was able to confirm what I'd thought. The two phone tapping reports related to Trendall's secretary making phone calls to the Soviet embassy in Canberra to arrange his visa for a research trip to Russia in 1963. And my parents' friend told me that, of course, in the Cold War, ASIO routinely surveillanced the Soviet embassy. But ASIO at the time was also very interested in talking to any Australian who had been to Russia, not necessarily because they were suspicious, but just for their general impressions. And that might explain the interview of 1964. But I did wonder if there might be something else in there. Now, these ASIO reports are heavily redacted, but nevertheless, the interview report told us something we hadn't previously known. We had known that Trendall visited the USSR in the 1960s. But what this interview report also told us was that he visited in 1936. Now, cast your minds back. Dale Trendall had graduated from Trinity College, Cambridge in 1933. And in the same year, Kim Philby graduated in economics from Trinity College. Guy Burgess graduated at Trinity in 1933 in modern languages. And Anthony Blunt, who'd also studied modern languages at Trinity, was elected to a fellowship in 1932, and he later became the keeper of the Queen's pictures. He was an art historian. And just next door at Trinity Hall, Donald MacLean graduated in 1934, again in modern languages. In other words, Dale Trendall was an exact contemporary of the so-called Cambridge Five, the ring of British spies who acted as double agents and passed on information to the Soviet Union during the Second World War. Now, there's nothing to connect Trendle directly with these spies, but they've never identified the fifth man, and I did find myself wondering, could it be Trendle? I don't think so. In fact, more recent research suggests that it was not so much the Cambridge Five as the Cambridge 50. It was rife. But nevertheless, in the confines of a Cambridge college in the 1930s, while they might not have been friends, Trendle must have known these people. Now, Trendle's ASIO interview took place just a few months after Anthony Blunt had made his secret confession to MI5 in 1964. And I just wondered, could there possibly be any connection there? Like Blunt, Trendle was an art historian, which is a really good cover for making a trip to Russia. So I asked my parents' friend, and I said, is this really too speculative? And he said, well, it is, but it's not impossible. He thought that if MI5 had had reason to contact ASIO, they would have done so. Now, we'll never know for sure. My parents' friend did also suggest that I should try to get unredacted reports. He couldn't really see why they still had to be redacted. So I contacted ASIO. I discovered you can't email ASIO. Funnily enough, you can telephone them or you can write to them. So I called and we had quite a long conversation. The person on the other end of the phone took down details so that they could find the relevant documents and told me they hoped that somebody would call me back, but they couldn't guarantee it. So the weeks went by and I'd lost hope. But then one day I'm working in my office and the phone rings and it's ASIO on the phone. And the answer, though, was firmly no, for two reasons. One is that ASIO apparently never unredacts interview reports, that is to assure all future interviewees of complete confidentiality. And the other is apparently because even after more than 50 years, the interview report still contains sensitive information. The mind boggles. I had to bite my tongue not to start begging the spy on the other end of the phone to tell me. So, to conclude, just a few snippets of an epilogue. Anastasius Trewick, in time, became Professor of Greek at Sydney University. And after the war, in the 1950s, when Michael Ventris and John Chadwick published their decipherment of the ancient Greek Mycenaean script Linear B, Trewick put his code-breaking skills to work to prove that Ventris and Chadwick were right and their detractors were wrong. Ronald Bond and Dale Trendle remained friends after the war, and Bond went on to become a very admired teacher and vice principal of Scotch College in Melbourne. Arthur Cooper, even though he'd spent less than a year at Monterey, never forgot Dale Trendle. In 1973, nearly 30 years after the war, Cooper published his translation of the works of the 8th century CE Chinese poets Li Po and Tu Fu. And he sent a copy of his book to Trendle. We have it in the Trendle Centre. And on the inside cover, in Chinese characters, was the message, "Our live long days, we meeting, move as do stars in other clusters." And Cooper wrote on the flyleaf, "For Dale Trendle, with happy memories of a working partnership in Melbourne many years ago, and all my respectful good wishes from Arthur Cooper, so much encouraged by ADT, Arthur Dale Trendle." In an interview for a book published in 1992, Commander Eric Nave described Trendle as the best of the cryptographers. And in 1995, Dale Trendle died. He'd moved to ANU in 1954 as Master of University House and also Deputy Vice Chancellor. And from there, he went to La Trobe University as the first and only resident fellow. And his bequest to La Trobe resulted in the establishment of the A.D. Trendle Research Centre for Ancient Mediterranean Studies. And the centre contains not only a superb library, which is maintained by Trendle's bequest, but also his archive of some 40,000 photographs of South Italian vases. And it is, to this day, impossible to do anything in the field of South Italian vase painting, or indeed in the archaeology of southern Italy and Sicily in the classical period, without reference to Trendle's work. Tertius, the highly illegal Gibbon, ended his days happily in Melbourne Zoo, but in 2017 acquired immortal fame with the publication of a really lovely children's book called My Friend Tertius by Corinne Fenton and illustrated by Owen Swan. And it tells the story of Arthur Cooper and his pet Gibbon. Now, if Dale Trendall is up there somewhere looking down on us all, he probably isn't best pleased with me. He was, as I said, extremely reluctant to recall and talk about his work during the Second World War. But I think, and I hope you'll agree with me, that the story of Trendall's wartime work is too interesting and too important not to be told. And also that his studies in vase painting were integral to his brilliance as both a code breaker and a code writer. In that 1990 interview, Trendall was asked about the process of code breaking, and I wonder if his musings on the subject could not also be applied to the process of his attribution in vase painting. He said, "You get a feeling for it. Your eye lights upon something and bang." Thank you very much.
What a remarkable life and story of one Arthur Dale Trendall, as told by Dr. Gillian Shepherd, Director of the Trendall Research Centre for Ancient Mediterranean Studies and a senior lecturer in classics and ancient history at La Trobe University. And thanks to her and to our hosts today of this event, Melbourne's Shrine of Remembrance. Now, I want to tell you about our next episode, a pivotal moment in Australian political history. We are marking 50 years since the dismissal. And as historian Frank Bongiorno remembers, emotions ran high.
This is a period when, what, probably 60% of Australian workers were in unions. So, you know, immediately you have a strike of 100,000 metal workers. The whole issue of a general strike was a live one in the aftermath of the dismissal on the 11th of November. And it's an event that was played out on the streets and in the squares, marches on Liberal Party headquarters in Melbourne, broken windows, letter bombs. One went off and injured some workers in the, I think it was the executive building in Brisbane. It was directed at Joe Bjelke-Petersen, but there were letter bombs sent elsewhere as well. So, you know, there was a real, I think, a sense of the spectre of civil violence in 1975. And one of the really forgotten dynamics of the dismissal is how many figures, Kerr is one of them, we know from the Palace letters, but we also know of other figures within the Liberal Party and beyond it, who feared what would happen in the event of a dismissal of that government, who feared that, social tensions were being, raised to such a level that any government that emerged from it would be regarded as utterly illegitimate, particularly by the union movement, which is overwhelmingly the important social movement of the day because of its sheer numbers and its power. And we have, some really vivid images of the protest outside Parliament House, even the ones involving the comedian Gary McDonald as Norman Gunston, you might recall as well. I think he called you Mr. Frazier. remember, Labor boycotted the opening of Parliament. Labor boycotted every public event that involved John Kerr in the aftermath of the dismissal until he departed office at the end of 1977. This was a really passionate business, and people did maintain the rage, as Whitlam had enjoined them to do.
A conversation about Gough Whitlam's dismissal and why it is still relevant to today. That's coming up on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National, your live event show, Big Thinkers at the Best Live Events. That is what we are all about. And we love hearing from you with your feedback about what you're hearing. We hear you on the text line as you're listening to the midday edition. Or you can email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. Just scribble us a message. We want to hear from you. My name is Natasha Mitchell. Great to have your company today. Catch you next time. Bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.